April 2021 marks 30 years since the Royal Commission for Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. That Royal Commission handed down 339 recommendations, and the implementation of those recommendations has been completely woeful. The Guardian Australia website has a whole section dedicated to deaths in custody because the state can't seem to stop killing Aboriginal people. That section has nearly 300 articles, including some from last month, detailing the news that three Aboriginal people died in custody in 1 week, and a fourth just last week in Broken Hill.
Shame.
The news of the first two of those deaths, which happened in New South Wales, only came to light when New South Wales Greens MP David Shoebridge questioned the Commissioner of Corrective Services about budget estimates. He told the State Parliament that the government didn't publicise those deaths because, quote, it was not appropriate to advise the public of deaths without any detail because it would cause a lot of anger, a lot of angst, and a lot of grief. Anger entirely directed towards you.
Yeah.
Over 400 Indigenous people have died in custody and no one has ever been held accountable. And it was in this context that Scott Morrison tried to say that none of this mattered in the run-up to the massive Black Lives Matter protests against the murder of George Floyd in June of last year. He said, we shouldn't be importing the things that are happening overseas to Australia. I'm not saying we don't have issues in this space that we need to deal with, but the thing is we are dealing with it. And we don't need to draw equivalents here. We should be Australians about this and deal with it our way. No, I'm not from Australia. Can you all enlighten me about what that means? What the Australian way of dealing with it means? Because I think it means just pretending it doesn't happen and hoping it will go away. Here in Australia, One Nation politicians Pauline Hanson, Mark Latham or Malcolm Roberts are not outlines, somehow representing something un-Australian with their rhetoric. They are echoing and building on what they hear from the mouths of mainstream politicians and media outlets every day. Like Scott Morrison, saying the 26th of January 1788 wasn't a particularly flash day for those on the first front, as if there's some equivalency between them and the millions of Indigenous people killed in the subsequent genocide. Or the unbelievable amount of racism directed towards AFL player Eretie Lumumba by the media when he spoke out about the racism he experienced at Collingwood. But Lumumba was highlighting broader societal problems. Reporters called him worldly, deep-thinking, level-headed and well-liked. He was a role model, a leader, and the highest accolade for an Aussie man, a great bloke. But when he called out Collingwood's hypocrisy around their outward aspirations for diversity and equality and tolerance, he was angry, disgruntled, dramatic, high-maintenance. He was a non-conformist, a hindrance, forever taking the high moral ground. But as the historian Marilyn Lake asked in the aftermath of the Cronulla riots in 2005, what is un-Australian about calling for racial exclusion in the name of the nation? Yeah. Is not racial exclusion a deep part of our heritage, as traditional an Australian value as nature? Australia as a country began with white supremacy at its heart, with the genocide of the oldest continuous civilization on the planet, continues to deny its existence and the impact of that genocide on the lives of Aboriginal people today. It seems like every few years there's a new form of racism to fight. If it's not Black people, it's Muslims. If it's not them, it's refugees or migrants. Then it's the Africans, then it's the Asians again. It just keeps coming back, as we saw again with the horrific murder of Asian women in the US a few weeks ago. Despite the fury of people across the world wearing every day and declarations that we must do better, it's easy to feel like the fight against racism is futile, like we'll never win. But this is because the ruling class will always use racism to divide us and allow minorities to be used as scapegoats for the problems they themselves create, and they change the way they use racism to fit with the times. Marxists have something very particular to offer in the fight against racism because we understand that what is socially rooted can be socially uprooted. We can see that the fight against racism lies with the majority of ordinary people recognising the function that racism has under capitalism and can decide that they won't stand for it anymore. And they do that through the process of struggle, Every time they stand up for their non-white co-worker or school friend, stranger on the bus, they undermine the catalyst and their need for division among ordinary people. So I think it's important to start off by saying that racism hasn't always existed. There are contradictory arguments about this, though. The common explanations that we hear about either it's inherent to human nature and therefore will always exist, or if we can get rid of it, it means getting rid of a few bad apples who just need better education or training. Or actually, maybe it's the real problem, it's just white people and their privilege and their unconscious biases. But just to address that first one, if it was inherent to human nature, we would see it throughout human history. And this simply isn't the case. Ancient Greek and Roman civilizations certainly had their prejudices, but it wasn't on the basis of a person's skin colour. They certainly had the slave society, but there was no visible marker to identify the slave. As C.L.R. James writes, historically, it is pretty well proved that the ancient Greeks and Romans knew nothing about race. They had another standard, civilized and barbarian. And you could have white skin and be barbarian, and you could be black and be civilized. So you could be white and be a slave, or be black and be a Roman emperor. Toni Morrison, the wonderful African-American writer, said, there is no such thing as race. None. There is just the human race, scientifically, anthropologically. Racism is a construct, a social construct. And she's completely right. Scientifically, there are more genetic variations within so-called races than there are between them. So, if there's no such thing as race, what do we mean by racism? My definition is one where an entire group of people are systematically oppressed and discriminated against on the basis of assumed shared characteristics. And they usually share those characteristics based on their skin colour, although not exclusively if you look at things like anti-Irish racism, for example. But it's also about power and oppression. When you have the power to change the course of someone's life due to their race. So there's no such thing as reverse racism. As Malcolm X said, if we react to white racism with a violent reaction, to me, that's not black racism. If you come put a rope around my neck and I hang you for it, to me, that's not racism. Yours is the racism, but my reaction has nothing to do with racism. So where does racism come from? The racism that we have come to understand it. Peter Fryer, in his collection of essays, Aspects of Black British History, says that racism has had a precise social function under capitalism, as an ideology to justify the exploitation and domination of people. So we see racism arise with the development of capitalism. And I think that the understanding the rise of capitalism and the transatlantic slave trade in particular is key to understanding the development of racism, this particular form of exploitation. We've had just over 400 years of the ruling class trying to use race in different ways to justify the exploitation of people so they can make a ton of money. Trinidadian historian Eric Williams, in his seminal text, Capitalism and Slavery, talks about how British capitalism relied on the slave trade to cement this domination around the world. They grew cotton and sugar in its colonies and then brought back those products back to Britain to fuel its industrial demands. Cities like Liverpool, Bristol, and Manchester were literally built on the backs of slave labour. Eric Williams puts it like this. Britain's mechanised might was making the whole world her footstool. She was clothing the world, exporting men and machines, and had become the world's banker. He talks at length about British capitalism and its rapid expansion. British cotton imports rose from £11 million in 1784 to £283 million in 1832, less than 50 years. In the space of 64 years, the American colony had gone from providing 0.01% to 80% of Britain's cotton. The planters in America and the Caribbean needed to keep up with the pace, and their reliance on indigenous and white workers wasn't keeping up with demand. The planters needed labour. So they came up with the idea of using people from their other colonies in Africa to make up for the labour shortage. Here's Williams again. Here, then, is the origin of Negro slavery. The reason was economic, not racial. It had to do not with the colour of the labourer, but the cheapness of the labour. The features of the man, His hair, colour and denture face, his subhuman characteristics are so widely viewed, were only the later rationalisations to justify a simple economic fact that the colonies needed labour and resorted to Negro labour because it was cheapest and best. This was not a theory. It was a practical conclusion deduced from the previous experience of the planter. He would have gone to the moon, if necessary, for labour. Africa was nearer than the moon, nearer too than the more populous countries of India and China, but their turn was to come. So it's commonly assumed that white supremacy drove slavery, but in fact it was the other way around. As Williams puts it, slavery was not born of racism, rather racism was the consequence of slavery. The purpose of racism was to ideologically justify and help maintain an extremely profitable system of unfree labour. They literally invented and created a reason why they were allowed to treat black people in this way. In his wonderful book, The Black Jacobins, C.L.R. James writes, "The Negroes," says a memoir published in 1789, "are unjust, cruel, barbarous, half-human, treacherous, deceitful, thieves, drunkards, proud, lazy, unclean, shameless, jealous to fury, and cowards. It was by sentiments such as these that they strove to justify the abominable cruelties they practiced." These opinions were absolutely essential to the continued repression of black people, but were also important to stop their resistance. They kept rebelling on the plantations, robbing and sometimes killing their masters or running away entirely. Enslaved people resisted during the passage on ships from Africa to the Caribbean or the American colonies. They resisted on the plantations and they continued to resist until they were free. D.L.R. James talks about the hundreds of slave rebellions that happened on plantations and says, "The only place the Negroes did not revolt is in the pages of the capitalist historians." In other words, they have been written out of history. And they were written out of history in order to dehumanize them. If they had no agency, no ideas, no personhood, white people would find it harder to stand in solidarity with them, to join forces and fight for better conditions. The plantation owners faced a double threat from the enslaved Africans and the majority of whites who made up the labouring class too. If black and white labour lived and worked together, they could also resist together. So they needed racism to keep them divided. The white poor were given the idea of superiority simply due to their whiteness in order to mitigate against their poorness so that they would feel a kinship with the white rulers. White people were led to think that they had a stake in the system as they appeared to be materially better off than black people, especially with new laws introduced allowing legal discrimination purely on the basis of race. And there were somewhat successful attempts made to get them to identify with the white ruling class. The abolitionist Frederick Douglass writes, "The hostility between the whites and blacks of the South is easily explained. It has its root and sap in the relation of slavery and was incited on both sides by the coming of the slave masters. Those masters secured their ascendancy over both the poor whites and the blacks by putting enmity between them. They divided both to conquer each." The ruling class also invented, because let's not say they don't use their imagination, they invented 128 categories of mulatto, of people with mixed race heritage, which in turn determined rights. If you had a certain amount of black in you, you could own a certain amount of land, you could live in certain places, you could have certain jobs. It was a pure creation used to control both the black slave population as well as the mixed race people themselves. They would begin to identify someone with the plantation owners rather than the slaves. But it's interesting to see how these ideas persist and adapt. Later in the Jim Crow South, if you had one drop of black in you, black blood in you, you were considered entirely black by law and legally discriminated against. And now we have people like Sharon Osbourne saying that Meghan Markle ain't really black, so she can't really experience racism, and the royal family questioning how dark her kid's skin was likely to be. But surely, this racism that I've talked about is just representative of the kind of bigotry that dominated society hundreds of years ago. But even figures from the Enlightenment period, people with otherwise progressive ideas, fell into the traps that the system set for them. Sometimes people are surprised by this, by the idea that someone like Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the US Declaration of Independence, could be a slave owner and write In that document, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Gender politics aside, this was a radical statement for the time. Like Jefferson, others who threw around phrases inspired by the French Revolution, like liberty, equality, and fraternity, justified racism because they financially benefited from the slave trade. Ideas of racial superiority were explained and justified on a pseudo-scientific basis. Sure, all men might be created equal, but black people aren't really people, so they don't care. They're uncivilized, they're not like us, their brains are not like ours, and so on. But despite the so-called progressives of the day using the same rhetoric as the ruling class, there was always resistance to the barbarity of the slave trade. Anti-racism has existed as long as racism has. And while it was difficult for the abolitionist movement to gain traction because slavery was such an integral part of the way society functioned, they did keep going. The abolition movement in Britain was the first mass movement of its kind which pioneered all the techniques of campaigning that we're used to today. Mass leafleting, the use of powerful images, the idea of wearing a badge, flyer posting, speaking tours, and so on. It led a movement that made ordinary people see what really lay behind the sugar they ate, the tobacco they smoked, the coffee and tea they drank, and organised boycotts of products grown on slave plantations. They gathered the biggest number of petitions ever sent to Parliament in its history. And all of this took place in a country whose empire was economically reliant on the slave trade. This mass movement was responsible for changing an entire country's opinion on a subject that brought so much prosperity to the country. The slogan of the movement was, "A Negro is my man, is a man and my brother." This was a huge statement to make at the time. Manchester alone collected 10,000 signatories, one in five people in the city. Later, when the expansion of slavery was one of the reasons for the start of the American Civil War, Marx and Engels and other committed socialists made sure that the burgeoning labour movement in England supported the North, despite the fact that their own jobs were in industries that relied on slave labour. They were able to pass motions of support for the North based on the ideas of justice and international solidarity, with Marx saying, "Labour with a white skin cannot be free while labour with a black skin is in chains." So, why didn't racism end with the abolition of slavery if it was developed simply as a means to justify slavery? Well, if the slave trade was central to the development of racism, then imperialism is central to its continued perpetuation. We can see this with the expansion of the British Empire through colonisation in the 19th century. In order to justify their rule over millions of people from the Indian subcontinent and from there elsewhere in Asia and in Africa, they used the same racist lies, just told in a slightly different way. They used paternalism, the idea that they were like children, simply incapable of looking after themselves, that this was just another way of dehumanising them. And we see similar paternalistic attitudes in more recent times with the bombing of Afghanistan and Iraq, supposedly justified, if you believe the likes of Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton, on the basis of freeing these poor, oppressed women from the horrors of patriarchal Islam. And we see similar rhetoric used about protecting Aboriginal women and children from domestic violence and child abuse as a justification for the unprecedented rate of child removals through the Northern Territory intervention, as well as more recently. The fact that they had to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act in order to carry out the intervention tells you that they knew exactly what they were doing. So under capitalism, borders do not stand in the way of capital, but they certainly stand in the way of the people that want to follow that capital. Again, we see capitalism adapting its use of racism. So the latest enemy are migrants. Despite the ruling class actually creating this problem in the pursuit of profits, it's the immigrants who are somehow simultaneously the ones taking all the jobs as well as being dull budgets. All sorts of people can fall for the nationalism that gets whipped up around these kinds of questions. We see it sometimes with trade unions calling for Aussie jobs for Aussie workers, as well as others with perhaps slightly more left-wing credentials. People may have seen the stuff around Clive Hamilton a couple of years ago. There was a book called Silent Invasion, talking about China's dark influence over Australian politics, something which has gained more traction since the pandemic. As Australian imperialism comes under threat from China, the ruling class will stop at nothing to make us fear and hate China, Chinese people, 1.2 million people of Chinese descent living in Australia, just like the population was urged to hate the Germans and Japanese during previous imperialist wars. But everything has to be driven into the hearts and minds of people. There's nothing natural about people hating Black or Aboriginal people, or hating the Chinese people as the ones responsible for this threat against the nation, or hating Muslims for this supposed threat to the Western way of life. To paraphrase something one of our comrades said once, if racism is so natural, why do they have to work so bloody hard to make sure it sticks? Because racism comes from the top of society, we see them having to put so much effort in to make sure that racism thrives among those at the bottom. So, what do Marxists say about fighting racism today? As much as challenging everyday occurrences of racism matters and matters a lot, any serious fight against racism has to go beyond the individual and must have a serious critique of capitalism, because it's the system of capitalism that is destroying us, I mean, literally, in the case of climate change. Towards the end of his life, Martin Luther King said, "I've come upon something that disturbs me deeply. We fought hard and long for integration, as I believe we should have, and I know that we will win. But I've come to believe we're integrating into a burning house." We know it's not possible to get rid of capitalism without working class unity, breaking down the divisions this rotten system creates and that the ruling class exploits. So any fight against capitalism has to have anti-racism at its heart. And racism is a tool that doesn't just impact people of colour in today's society, but obviously also white people. So in the southern states of the US, the area of the country which has the most entrenched racism, it also has the lowest wages and levels of unionisation, showing that white people do not, in fact, materially benefit from racism. And this is not a new phenomenon. In 1870, Karl Marx described the working class in England as divided into two hostile camps, the English and the Irish. And that this was the secret of the impotence of the English working class. Marx recognised how these divisions were artificially kept alive and intensified by the press, the pulpit, the comic papers, in short, by all the means at the disposal of the ruling class, which is the secret by which the capitalist class maintains its power. And that class is fully aware of it. Sounds familiar, I think. And he knew that just as Marxists today know that the English working class back then had to be at the forefront of the struggle for Irish independence if it was ever going to become a revolutionary force in the fight against capitalism. Racism retakes in response to the challenges that it faces from people from below. An important tool in this mutation is the racialization of crime in the UK, the US, and Australia, with things like Operation Trident, the police operation in the UK that was set up to investigate so-called black-on-black crime, the whole war on drugs in the US, about which the people directly involved have confirmed that it was in fact a war on black people, or the domination of media headlines creating hysteria about African gangs. Even the Victorian police had to tell them to scale back on because it simply wasn't true. Now, I came to Australia about 5.5 years ago. And in that time, the following incidents have made headlines. Fraser Allen calling for a final solution on immigration. 100% of youth detainees in the Northern Territory being Indigenous. 1 in 5 Chinese Australians reporting being attacked or physically threatened in the past year since the pandemic. The arrest of an Aboriginal woman, Aileen Roy, for being drunk in her own home. Pauline Hanson accusing Muslim men of having multiple wives and multiple children in order to defraud Centrelink. Breakfast Show Sunrise, casually talking about starting another stolen generation because Aboriginal people apparently can't look after their own children. A footage of a Brisbane private schoolboy physically attacking another by kneeling on his neck, mimicking the murder of George Floyd. From my name, why do you move to Australia? Some of this stuff happens so casually, so frequently, that I think we forget to notice that it's just plain racism.
Yeah.
Now, racism might look different today from how it did 20, 50, 100 years ago. There isn't the same level of verbal abuse or racist attacks in the street, although we do see that more and more when you see like the videos of people in the US who can't quite seem to cope with the existence of black people for some reason. But the systematic and structural discrimination remains. The ruling class continue to use racism in more subtle ways to drive its insatiable quest for profits by using things like the argument of scarcity to divide people. In the last New South Wales state election, both Labor and Liberals called for a pause on immigration as hospitals and transport weren't up to the job, rather than admitting that they weren't up to the job because successive state governments failed to invest in the problem. And since losing the unlosable federal election in 2019, Labor started saying that perhaps they were unsuccessful because they weren't tougher on immigration, or because they were losing the religious right in places like Western Sydney because of their position on marriage equality.
Shame.
Classic divide and rule. Instead of paying attention to the things that ordinary people say they want to radically improve their lives, they decide to just blame ordinary people and divide them even more. But this tactic doesn't always work. People see through it time and time again. They see past their differences and focus on the real enemy, whether that's in the Invasion Day rallies or the magnificent White Lives Matter rallies around the world last year. And I think it's worth saying just a little bit about those uprisings that we saw in the US last year, we sometimes see in Aboriginal communities and here as well. Because people who take part in riots and looting are condemned for not protesting in the right way. How many times have we heard, I agree with what they're protesting about, but the looting and rioting is the wrong way to go about it, or smashing windows just hurts the cause. Turning violent means that you're making it harder for people to support you.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly when it became accepted that a shop window or a McDonald's was worth more than a black person's life,
yeah.
But it's clear that this is what they mean when they say things like this. The same was said in the wake of riots in 1968, when a week of rioting broke out in 100 cities after MLK's assassination, and the rioters were accused of undoing all the good work that MLK had done. He himself called these people white moderates, more devoted to order than justice. As Daniel Taylor wrote in an article for Red Flag last year, riots illustrate the depth and breadth of popular hatred of the establishment, of the alienation from its institutions, and of the willingness to fight by any means necessary. Riots are the expression of outrage, of a feeling so deep that it can't be contained any longer, and it must be expressed in whatever way you think people will listen. Colin Kaepernick took a knee and was told that that wasn't the right way either. There is never a right way to call out institutional racism or the capitalist system that creates it according to the purveyors of that system.
Yeah.
We'll be waiting a long time before we come up with something that the system approves of. Riots can be glorious, beautiful, creative affairs that give ordinary people a sense of their own power. So, to start wrapping up, I came across this lovely quote from Peter Fryer where he says, "It must never be forgotten that the ruling class did not hand over civil liberties to the working class on a plate. The working class had to struggle for them, and that struggle was long, hard, and bitter. Our civil liberties were won and struggled by men and women who had the guts to endure vilification, arrest, imprisonment, and transportation, and face even the prospect of execution. Let us do all we can to make sure that their tradition and their contribution are never forgotten." For socialists, our aim is to build movements that challenge racism and to fight on the bread and butter issues that affect black and white workers alike. By working together and following in the footsteps of some of the movements that have gone before us, we can begin to build the sort of society we want. All of this means that class politics matters more than ever. If we ask ourselves, how can an anti-racist movement win? The answer you get if you look at social media and elsewhere is that winning is about white people acknowledging and accepting their privilege and allowing space to listen to black and other marginalised voices. The problem with this approach is that it doesn't impact on anything, but it certainly doesn't impact on the roots of racism and oppression, which is capitalism. This kind of identity politics ultimately believes in the inherent democracy of capitalism and doesn't think that it can or should be challenged. So the only thing to do in that circumstance is to raise black voices. But there isn't one single black voice. So to amplify and listen to black voices actually means amplifying and listening to certain black voices, usually conservative, right-wing ones, not the ones who want to challenge the whole system, like mine. Having an understanding of how and why class matters in this discussion is important. I'm much more interested in what black bus drivers, nurses, firefighters, supermarket workers think than what the likes of Barack Obama might have to say. During the Black Lives Matter protests last year, Obama talked about wanting to see peace restored and normality restored as soon as possible. Although that normality felt much like peace to those of the bottom of society, a movement made up of ordinary people, black and white, Asian and Latinx, queer and straight people struggling in the streets of the US, of the UK, of Australia, indeed all over the world last year, showed us how things could change. They offered a glimpse of what it would feel like if we controlled things, if we made the decisions, if we, in the words of Nina Simone, knew how it would feel to be free. Ordinary people have won victories in the past, in the campaign to abolish the slave trade, the campaign for civil rights in both the US and Australia, the campaign for equal marriage. This is the tradition we stand in, and it's from the shoulders of those activists who came before us that we can see the possibility and necessity of another world. A world free from exploitation, capitalism, and war, a world of true liberation for everyone.